It's the 20th of January. Can I still say Happy New Year? You bet I can. Happy New Year, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another Hidden Mentality episode. The big 26 is upon us, and today we've got Dr. Andrew L. Blackwood, known as Coach Drew. He is a mental health professional who has worked as a psychotherapist and family therapist. Drawing from both personal experience and professional practice, Dr. Blackwood helps people build emotional resilience, self-awareness, and healthier inner lives. What if anxiety isn't a flaw, but a misunderstood response to the way your mind imagines the future? In this episode, Dr. Blackwood breaks down what anxiety actually is, why your body reacts to thoughts as if they're real, and how specific thought patterns quietly fuel overthinking, spirals, and self-doubt. We explore why anxiety can sometimes protect you, and when it starts to hijack your life. Dr. Blackwood introduces the ATI process and unpacks the most common anxiety-producing thought patterns. You'll learn practical exit strategies for each pattern alongside how to calm your nervous system before changing your thoughts. Whether you struggle with overthinking, self-criticism, or feeling stuck in your own head, this episode offers you a clear framework to understand why you feel anxious and how to respond with clarity, compassion, and control. So, in the big 2026, please help me welcome Dr. Andrew L. Blackwood. What is anxiety's purpose?
Well, very good question, which requires some unpacking first. Before we can talk about the purpose of the thing, it's good to know what the thing is so we're on the same page.
Yep.
So anxiety is an emotion, but it is also an experience that exists on a spectrum. Okay? And it's an emotion that we feel in our bodies, but it's caused by a negative picture of the future. So there are many factors that contribute to our experiences of anxiety, whether they are genetic, environmental, developmental, biological. You know, what you eat can impact your level of anxiety. How much sleep you have or don't have could impact your level of anxiety. But ultimately, the most common experience is that negative picture in our minds that gets thrown on the screen of our with our imagination, and our bodies pick up on it as if it is real.
That's fascinating. So would it then be fair to say, on the most basic level, anxiety is a universal experience?
Universal is quite absolute, because there are some people, for one reason or another, who don't feel pretty much anything. So I would say, by and large, it's practically universal, but I try to stay away from absolutes. But for most people who experience anxiety, yes, there are some common elements around it by virtue of just being on the planet, seeing, hearing, feeling. So it is very, very common.
I tend to see that our psychology is quite linked to biological instincts. So when you say anxiety is almost a negative picture of our future, is that just a biological primary instinct that we've just developed as humans that's kept us safe in survival?
I definitely think there are elements woven into who we are as people that are, they contribute to our protection, our preservation, by the nature with which we've been created, for sure. I would agree with that.
Yeah. And do you think anxiety is something to be solved or understood?
Well, I think they are one and the same. Right? When we understand things, then most of the issues that we have with them can be appropriately addressed. So again, let's look at the spectrum. If you are nervous about something, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad. However, if you are nervous all the time to a heightened degree, and there is no real benefit or need for that degree of nervousness or anxiety, then that's problematic.
Yeah, I've always said that my best journey checkpoints where I've made a significant movement in my life, whether it's physical or just mentally, they've come from negative experiences. So would anxiety, if it's a negative picture of a future, almost be a motivator for change?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. But not all the changes that we make in our lives because of fear are actually based on accurate information or a healthy perspective. So a lot of the people who have significant challenges with anxiety, there are patterns of thought that they are unaware of that get triggered during seasons of stress or transition and change. And it moves them away from being the best version of themselves as opposed to moving them into more of who they've been created to be.
Yeah, at what point would anxiety prevent us from moving to a better point in our life?
Oh, in so many ways, so many instances. Sometimes we say no to things because we're afraid, because we believe we are inadequate, we believe we are incapable, we believe something that has happened before will happen again. So those worries can prevent us from stepping into opportunities that are just waiting for us to show up and move to the next level and being the best version of ourselves at that point in time.
That's fascinating, right? That there's like almost a small amount of anxiety that could potentially move you to a better point in your life because you could take action on it. But then there's on the other side of it, there could be so much anxiety that action is then prohibited due to the thought, which then doesn't even allow you to move. How do we even strike the right balance where anxiety isn't your enemy, right, it's your friend?
Right. Well, I think it's a matter of what I call the ATI process.
Okay.
So one of the things that I encourage pretty much everyone I work with to do is to journal. And when you journal and you learn how to journal effectively, you end up processing your experiences and your emotions as opposed to just experiencing them or being overwhelmed by them or avoiding them. That's one of the signs of problematic experiences with anxiety. We engage in avoidance. An avoidant behavior could be moving away from something. It could be distracting ourselves. It could be coping with unhealthy things. So being able to reflect on what you are feeling and what you are thinking, in keeping with what I call the ATI process, is you're going to increase your awareness of what you're feeling physiologically in your body. You're going to increase your awareness by labeling the emotion, but you're also going to increase your awareness by defining the thought that is fueling the emotion. Because after we become aware and we learn to do what I call the T, which is tolerate what we become aware of. So if we're dealing with our emotions and the physiological sensations, this is where breathing comes in, where we learn to calm ourselves and we reset and we learn to rewire the way that our brain reacts to certain situations. When we learn to do that, we can calm ourselves. It creates this objectivity between us and the thought. Now yeah. We can hold that, you know, okay, this is what I'm thinking. When I think this, when I imagine this, when I picture this, it causes me to feel this way, which is very different than our feelings being equated with fact. Just because you feel or think or perceive something doesn't mean that that is accurate or true. So based on that objectivity, now we can be intentional. We can say, okay, whenever I imagine this situation, I feel small. But in reality, I'm not small. I'm very capable. I can handle this, right? Whatever those thoughts are, we can now engage with them with intention, but only as we are aware and able to tolerate what it is that we feel and think.
Even bringing it back to the first step, do you think we should start understanding ourselves when anxiety hits, or even before that, to prevent anxiety from getting to us?
It is both. It is both. So there are going to be situations in life that are anxiety inducing. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. It's if there's an earthquake, the floor rips open in front of you. Are you going to be happy about that? Probably not, right? When unexpected traumatic things happen, it makes sense that we feel nervous, scared, unsettled, uneasy, unsure, unstable. There's a whole host of emotions that can be hidden within or under that umbrella of anxiety. So what we want to be able to do is be aware of what we're feeling so that we can address it. We can say, okay, this makes sense. This is not just common, but this is appropriate for the situation. So in this example, if there's an earthquake, we are going to be responsive. Our initially will be reactive, but we want to cultivate the skill so that we can be response-able, okay? So there's a difference between reactive, response-able or responsive, but then there's also proactive. So there's a situation that happens. We are going to hopefully not just react, but be able to respond. But to the point of your question, we don't have to wait to build a skill and capacity for something to happen. We can be proactive by journaling, by reflecting, by having healthy conversations, expanding our mind and our frame of reference, reading, doing all these things, or even exercising, learning about ourselves, learning about our history with anxiety. All that's proactive that helps us better respond to things when they happen.
You know, I've realized, and tell me if I'm wrong here, this is just an opinion I formed when it comes to, especially me, I'll be honest, we've agreed that anxiety isn't a universal experience, it is something that I can go through, and it's definitely impacted me and my journey to where I've got to. And what I've realized is, for me, there's almost two different sources anxiety comes from, which one is our objective conditions. So what you've just said, an earthquake has just hit me. The second one, which is fascinating to me, and almost in my case, it's more dangerous, is subjective dialogue, which is just my inner voice. So I either get anxiety from something is objectively happened to me in my life, or I get anxiety from me painting a subjective picture in my head, and that turns out to be more pervasive or dangerous.
Certainly, because the internal dialogue that we have, and it contributes to this internal culture that we have, the way that we function on the inside definitely informs and dictates how we engage with the outside, with the world beyond us. So yes, both of those are very real experiences, but they interplay constantly.
And does the preparation for something like we just talked about, when the earthquake hits, how do we be proactive? Is the preparation the same for when the subjective dialogue hits at a poor time?
So when you talk about a subjective dialogue hitting, that moves me to think about patterns of thought.
Exactly. Right?
So there are a number of different patterned ways of thinking. And if we're not aware of the pattern, then we can't exercise what I call authority in that area. I believe as human beings, we are created with the capacity, but also the design to exercise authority in our world and in our lives. And when we have trouble with that, then we don't live to be the full expression of who we've been created to be.
So what does that mean in the grand scheme of things? Is that almost self-acceptance, or is there something beyond that?
Self-awareness is important, right? So we want to be self-aware. And aware of those patterns is a part of that. So self-acceptance, it can be tricky. when I think of self-awareness, I think about or self-acceptance. Sometimes we can accept things as they are about us, or we can see our worth and our value even with these things that we want to change.
Mm.
Right? Because sometimes if we accept things that are a part of our life and are part of experience, like thought patterns, and we don't try to change it, those thought patterns, they don't just stay the same. They grow, they intensify, they become more deeply entrenched, and it impairs our functioning and impacts our lives. So we don't want to accept things in our lives that are not healthy that we can do something about.
Yeah, I mean, as a young man, I think the number one thing you, or at least me growing up, the stigma was, as men, we're not allowed to express our emotions, which then I guess we grew up with this idea that we can't really tackle our emotions, which is why for me, I was telling you before this, the recording, that, hey, this is a conversation I know I need to have, but it's something I was struggling to be proactive to find, just because this is a tough conversation in my head for me to go, hey, I know I should be sitting down with my emotions and dealing with them, because I'll be honest, you said it earlier, I like to distract myself and just call that the solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that highlights the difference between coping and change, right?
Okay.
We can do a lot of things that help us cope, but it doesn't promote growth. It doesn't better prepare us or equip us to deal with the situations that will come up in life. In life, there will be challenges. There's no doubt about that. So if we face challenges and then back away and reinforce ideas, those ideas then get internalized as beliefs. And then that's really where we live from.
So I guess there's a sense of vulnerability that's almost needed when, even if we're doing it by ourselves, like a journaling is a self activity, it still requires vulnerability, which at times I struggle with even when it's just me.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that then speaks to what you were talking about, the importance of self-acceptance, acknowledging the facts. We are human. We have limitations. We have vulnerabilities. We have a host of emotions. And this idea that men shouldn't feel, or real men, strong men, don't feel, is absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous, because we act from a place of emotion. So even the actions that are historically known as masculine, whether it's being protective or it's being expressive and, you know, charismatic, all of those expressions come from other emotions as well. You can be passionate about something. You being protective can also come from a place of fear. So it's important to understand the layers of these emotions that we, generally speaking, all have, so that we can be intentional as we express them.
So what is the first step as a young man for me to be vulnerable?
Ooh, good question. What is the first step? I wouldn't necessarily put them in an order.
Okay, that's fair.
There's several parts to it. That's a really good question. Okay, so part of being vulnerable, let's start with this. This is probably the clinical best approach here.
Yep.
Is to think about safety.
Mm.
Right. It makes no sense to be vulnerable in an environment that is not safe. So being good to yourself, for example, is an important part about experiencing vulnerability in healthy ways. Because if you are honest with yourself about something that you're not happy with and something that you're not proud of, and then you turn around and beat yourself up for it, What's that going to do to vulnerability? It's going to reinforce the idea that being vulnerable is stupid. It's not safe. You don't need it. Don't do it. So we want to look at how we are with ourselves. Are we good to ourselves? Are we kind to ourselves? What's that internal dialogue? Are we insulting ourselves? Let's talk a little bit about one of the patterns, for example. I have this online course called Conquering the Big Five, and it highlights five common and significant thought patterns, and there's a sixth one thrown in as a bonus, but that contribute to producing significant anxiety for us. So if we're looking at thought pattern number one, a lot of people know this as black and white thinking, all or nothing thinking. You know you are using this pattern when your language, whether it's interpersonally with other people or intrapersonally within yourself, if it's absolute, if it's extreme. Oh man, I always do this. I always screw up. I can't, right? I never get this right. Always, never, can't, everyone, everything, all, right? That extreme language is indicative of a black and white way of thinking.
Yeah.
If we look at that and if we respond to our own flaws, imperfections, mistakes, unwise choices, and we respond with all or nothing thinking, what does that do to you? You end up insulting, putting down yourself. You never should have done that. You should have known better. What's wrong with you? You're broken. You're this, you're that. So it sets up this internal dialogue and this culture towards yourself, towards weakness, towards vulnerability that is oppositional to what I believe is real and healthy growth.
I mean, black and white thinking, you've named one and you've managed to nail the one on the head for me. I am constantly telling myself, and it's also, it can be seen in the goals I set as well and when I don't hit the goals. For example, when I talked to Sathya about pornography, for example, we delved into this idea that typically men do this, or typically when people try to quit porn, they do this idea that, hey, let's just quit right now and we'll start a streak. And when they mess that streak up, they're like, hey, we can never do this because it's just all or nothing. And there's this idea that internal work needs to happen prior to setting up a streak or an all or nothing mindset. So with this all or nothing mindset, what kind of internal work do we need to do to get over that?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I love the question because it comes back to this process we're talking about, ATI. Are you aware of what you're saying? Are you aware of the feelings that it creates? Are you aware that this is a pattern? Because when you are aware, you can look back and be like, oh, yeah, that same way of thinking and responding was in this era of my life, in this moment, in this situation. Whoa, there's a pattern. It is not based on circumstance. It is a pattern that I carry with me. So awareness is important. Tolerance is critical. When these all or nothing thought patterns and this language creeps up, what emotions does it create for you? And are you aware and able to bring calm to your body so that you can then be intentional with the thought pattern? So each thought pattern has a particular exit strategy or number of exit strategies. Because if you try to use this exit strategy on other thought patterns, it's not going to be as effective. So The exit strategy for this one is pretty simple. Asking yourself, is this 100% true? Do I always mess up? Do I have to have a clean streak? Am I starting over from scratch? No, that's not exactly true. So if that's not true, what is more true? What is more accurate? And that invites us to look at things more objectively. It creates this moderation within us, and it gives us space to be imperfect, yet still progressive, and still wonderful, and still worthy of love, and all those kinds of things. So we can experience self-acceptance, we can experience acceptance of the facts, and we can address anxiety without it derailing us and either having to avoid it altogether or being totally incapacitated by it.
Yeah, it's you're spot on. I wonder if our thought pattern is a issue, how do we think ourselves out of a thinking problem? If that makes sense, right? If our thought pattern is the issue, how do we make sure that if we're going to do a exit strategy that involves thought, that thought isn't cursed or in the wrong spot?
So essentially, this is what we know as meta-thinking.
Yeah.
Thinking about what you're thinking. Thinking yep. about your thoughts. So it is rather analytical, which in and of itself is the ability to step back and reflect, right? We want to analyze it. We want to look at patterns. So it's a lot easier to do when we can bring calm to our bodies. If we are activated and we're on alert and we're in flight, freeze, you know, fight mode, we're not going to be able to create that objectivity, right? We're just going to be focused on saving ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we need a almost physiological change to derive objective thought. What are the other thought patterns you typically see?
Well, thought pattern number two, I call it the negative what ifs.
Oh, what if this damn. Happens, right? I feel like I do that too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most of us do. And, you know, I like to highlight the difference between worry and concern.
Okay.
I think it's. I know we're talking about anxiety, but there's so many different levels and variations and experiences within that umbrella. So this is one of the simple things that I encourage people to think about. So when we worry, it's these patterns that just spin and spin and spin. For example, what if it leads to catastrophizing? You start here and you go, what if this, what if this, what if this? And it's always negative. What if this, what if this, what if, and then it spirals. And then you're 10 years into the future, homeless, living under a bridge. Right?
You know? I've had that before.
Most people have. I was speaking at a school, my daughter's school, several months ago. And they were kids in the gymnasium from grade 1 to grade 8. And I asked, how many people worry about the future? Mm-hmm. And all these little kids' hands went up.
What?
Honestly, on the one hand, it broke my heart. But on the other hand, it reinforced this human experience, but also the importance of informing people, kids and parents, about what anxiety is, because even at that age they're worried about the future.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah. So worry is when these negative patterns, they spin and spin and spin. There's no real consideration of the likelihood or the probability of this worry materializing in the near future. And that's what moves us from worry to concern. How likely is this to happen? Is this something that I'm just spinning about? Because most of the things we worry about never happen. Or is there evidence and reason to believe that this is likely to transpire today or tomorrow, whatever? So, because concern leads to a plan of action, whereas worry usually just spins and spins and spins.
I like that. I like that a lot. And I have an interesting thought, actually. Would it be healthy to switch a negative what if to a positive what if?
That's one of the exit strategies.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah, for that pattern. So you're intuitively just, you're on it. Okay.
But I do think that requires the sense of, hey, the negative consequences can't be that deep for us to be even able to switch it to a positive what if. I still think that work needs to be done.
Well, yes, for sure. But the benefit comes when we recognize there's a pattern.
Yeah.
Right. when we can see the pattern, then we can start to calm ourselves to say, okay, I've thought like this before. What I worried about lots of times hasn't materialized. So what do I want to do with this thought?
Yeah, I mean, the positive what if is so funny to me because, I'm a 21-year-old guy, so as guy conversations typically go, I'll be talking to my mates and they want to ask out a girl or whatever it is. And some of them will go, yeah, I want to ask out this girl, but what if she says no? And then you flip the script and you go, what if she says yes? And it's just one of those things where the entire aroma just changes, it right? Does. The entire aura of the conversation changes.
Because in that moment, what you've done is you've, what I call, changed the channel. They're now watching a different show or movie play out on the screen of their minds. And that's what's changing their emotions. You haven't changed the future. You haven't predicted the future. You might have influenced the outcome by changing what you're imagining, which is important. So I think about that instance as an example of an exit strategy. But if we think about long-term growth, if that person has this pattern that gets activated in nervous situations or places of uncertainty, challenge, change, your one example, your one moment, your one experience of that what-if shift, if you think about it in terms of a ratio, that's one to millions. This is why this proactive approach is important. You want to be shifting that ratio regularly. You want to be informing this thought pattern and changing it. So every time you experience a negative what if, you can do a positive what if. You can do multiple positive what ifs. And, you know, positive what ifs are good, but I use the word alternative as opposed to just positive. We want to present different alternate imaginations because sometimes we've been in this negative cycle for so long that imagining something positive is really difficult. Because we don't, right? It's hard to picture it. But most importantly, this is where people get tripped up. They think imagining is the same as believing.
Okay. I need help explaining that.
Okay. So essentially you can posit a positive alternative.
Yep.
But they can't hold on to it because it seems so unrealistic to them.
Uh-huh.
Because they've spent most of the time imagining something negative.
A negative
that
experience,
they don't believe the imagination, right? They can't hold that imagination. So learning how to hold a positive or different picture, that's a skill set in and of itself. But most people are like, I don't believe it. I don't believe it because they don't feel it.
Yeah.
They don't feel it, right? What if it's positive? What if she says yes? Oh, she'll never say yes. Automatically, do you hear the all or nothing there?
Yes, I
right?
do.
So yes. This is how there's this interplay between these thought patterns. You posit a positive what if, and they counter it with a negative all or nothing.
Yeah, it's a skill to be positive about stuff. It's very true. And I find that so interesting because I forgot who I saw it from. I'm sure I saw it a few months ago in the summer. And it's so funny to me. It's just simply that, I think it was Alex Ramosi who said it. And he says, we find ourselves constantly being sad for no reason. Why don't we just be happy for no reason? And that skill in itself, I think I've got better over time about it, but it's still a skill that needs training to actually develop. And funnily enough that you brought it up, I'm not even trying to hype you up, but the way I've been training that skill is actually by journaling, because what I've realized is for me to be able to hold happiness for no reason, quote unquote, I tend to look for, typically before I started journaling, I tend to look for big moments in my life for me to be happy. And what I've realized is life is made up of 1,000 small moments and just a few big moments. And in my pursuit to be happy, my happiness relied on the big moments. But rather, if you actually start appreciating the small moments, that is what constitutes the deeper human experience, I guess, because...
Yes. So
I guess the small moments are now the big moments because I get to appreciate those more.
Right. So in essence, what you are saying is that you're no longer looking for a big reason to be happy.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
You are finding many little reasons to be happy. So you are now qualifying the reasons. So it doesn't have to be big to be important. It doesn't have to be huge to be significant and meaningful. So we're not sad for no reason. We're usually not aware of the reasons, the reasoning that is causing us to feel sad.
Right, because typically it's almost like a stigma, because how embarrassing must our life be if the best thing we did was walk our dog or have a workout? But then I look back to a year ago when I was doing 100 days of journaling, and my days would be filled with these small moments. Hey, I just bought a mic for my new podcast, da da da. And I'd look back, I'm like, those are proper days. But if I didn't journal at the time, I would just be like, hey, I didn't do much. I just went for a walk and bought a mic. These small moments just get derailed because we're looking for this big, oh, I got like 1,000 subscribers. I got 1 million subscribers today. That's a big day. That's but right. No, there's these small moments that we just tend to not credit.
Right. Because in instances like that, we are equating life with circumstances.
Yeah.
If we think circumstances is what makes life worthwhile, then when the circumstances aren't what we want them to be, then all of life sucks. It's all or nothing, right? So as you highlight the experience of appreciating the things that are significant, not necessarily sizable, you are highlighting what I call appropriating value, which is another word of assigning meaning or making meaning. And it's personal, it's individual. And that's one of the issues with comparison. You know, we will devalue the things that mean a lot to us because we're comparing them to the lives of other people.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? So walking my dog could mean the world to me, and that's enough for me. But because we think it's not as good as somebody else's life, or we think that other people think, which is one of the thought patterns, it's thought pattern number 4, actually. We think that we know what other people think and what means things to other people, and then we unintentionally invest stock in the imagined opinions of other people. And when we do that, we devalue our own thought.
Yeah, 100%.
Can you see how problematic that patterned way of thinking is?
Yeah. I mean, because life is a personal experience. If we're constantly holding on to someone else's version, you'll never be able to actually experience life for what it is.
Right. I agree. And it's not that other people's opinions don't matter. However, because I've come from this, I know this so well. If we're unintentionally devaluing our own opinion, our own beliefs, our own standards, our own values, we are inflating the opinions and values of other people. That impacts not only how we think about ourselves and how we value ourselves, it impacts our decision-making too.
Yeah.
What would this person think? What would this person think? No, I can't do that. Why not? And it's indiscriminate. It's so interesting. If you think about it this way, we value the opinions of people who don't know us, have nothing to do with our lives, have no, like, influencers. Who the heck cares? What? They don't know you. They don't know you. They don't care about you. They might be loving people, but the reality is they have no impact or import on your life unless you give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
So when we do this, we engage in this divesting of our own worth, our own esteem, our own power, our own authority, and we surrender it to people because of this thought pattern, and we don't even know it.
So thought pattern number one is all or nothing. Thought pattern number two is negative what ifs. Thought pattern number four is this inflation or surrendering to other people's opinions.
Well, it's basically mind reading. I know what she's going to think. I know what exactly. They would say, and right? And it blends into, well, what would this person say? Which you then imagine them saying it, which is like, what if they said this? Oh my goodness, right? So these patterns, they can intersect. But yes,
thought pattern what number four. What is number three?
Number three is future or fortune telling. Oh, I know this is going to happen. Oh, I know this is going to happen. Oh,
and that's linked to number two.
Yes, it's slightly different, but it can be linked. Well, what if this happens? Oh my gosh, yeah, that is going to happen. Oh, I know this is going to happen. So you hear the language. This is going to happen. Right. And it can link into number four. Well, I know she's going to be so upset. Oh, they're going to hate me. Right?
Yeah, I guess they're all interwoven. Yeah. Because right? this always happens. Yeah, of course.
Right? Yep. Right. So they can do that for sure.
And number three is fortune telling. So what is the distinct difference between number three and number two?
So number two is posited without certainty. It's not conclusive. That's what contributes to the spiraling. What if? What if? What if? And it is suggestive, whereas number three is, it's conclusive, it's certain. So the feeling is a lot more rigid. It's like, oh my God, I know it's going to happen. Whereas the feeling of thought pattern number two is kind of this agitation that just keeps amplifying itself, right?
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And the exit strategy for, would they be the same almost?
Slightly. There's some carryover. So for number three, do you know this is going to happen for sure? Like, can you tell the future? Do you know this? So you can predict the future. Really? Who can predict the future? Right. So it helps us to be real with ourselves to recognize I don't know. It's possible, right? But I don't know for sure. Then we transition into, well, how likely is this to happen? And what could you do or would you do if this did happen? It's much more empowering than believing that it is going to happen for sure.
Oh, God, I feel like I'm just on a call where I'm getting called out. This is just my thinking, because I'd like to think I don't know if it's a bad thing or not, but I'm definitely an overthinker, and I think my friends know it. We all laugh about it. So all these thought patterns, you've gone 4 for 4 here. Can you go 5 for 5?
Yeah, and I'll throw in the bonus one too. You're a special guy, so I'll go through all of them. So thought pattern number five, this is my least favorite phrase that really tells us we're using this, and it's so prevalent in Canadian culture. I believe American culture, you can tell me if it's the same as British or worldwide. It's called, I feel like statements.
Go on.
Well, I feel like this isn't going to work.
Oh, I use that all the time.
Right? I feel like I should just stop doing this right now. And what's really unhealthy about this is we use the word feel, but we don't transition into acknowledging an emotion.
What do you mean?
Well, I feel like this isn't going to work. Is that a feeling?
Oh yeah, it's just a observation.
Well, it's not even an observation. It's a thought. It's a perception. It's a belief. It's an opinion. This That's is right. not yeah, going yeah, to it's work. An opinion. Right? It's a thought. Yeah. So an observation is more factual. This is black. That's green. Those are facts.
Yeah.
Right? But a lot of the things we say, I feel like, they're not facts. Yeah. They are perceptions.
I've never thought about that, actually. Facts, right? That's a fascinating thought.
It is. So this is what happens when we use statements like that. It leads to emotional reasoning. You're using your emotion to come to a conclusion, but we don't realize the thought is driving the emotion. So we are subsuming, amalgamating our emotions with this belief, and we're not really recognizing it. They're fusing together, they're becoming cemented, and as good as fact when it's not actually true.
So it's anything but an observation, actually.
Right. So the exit strategy is twofold. Well, after we acknowledge, okay, I've used a feel-like statement, because I do this in my journal. When I experience intense emotions and challenges and worries, I am often using that phrase. I feel like, right? So then I pause and I go back and I say, what am I feeling? Because an emotion is a single or compound word. I'm feeling stuck. I'm feeling hesitant. I'm feeling unsure. You can even describe a physiological sensation, right? I feel agitated. I feel small. I feel ill-equipped, right? You use all these words and then you define the thought. I feel ill-equipped when I imagine myself being unsuccessful.
Yeah. You operationalize it. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you know you're using the feel like statement, when you say feel like, but then the defining of the thought, a thought is going to be multiple words. This is not going to work. Six words. That's not an emotion. So now when we've isolated the thought, this is not going to work. Do you see the thought pattern there?
Yep.
It is a combination of future telling, like I know this is not going to work, and all or nothing. This is not going to work at all. There's a 1-2 punch there, right?
So interesting.
So when you write that out, then you're like, well, it actually could work partially. What makes me think I have to have it all done right away? I can do just a small part. That's successful. That's valuable, right? Then we start to modify our expectations of ourselves or people of situations and things, which is a different way of thinking about things. But that comes by way of reflecting, knowing the thought patterns, and literally changing them by writing them out. Say, this is more balanced. This is more realistic. So this is the heart of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, right? You can be your own cognitive behavioral therapist if you understand the way that it works.
Because, you know, I've always been worried about trying to tackle my overthinking, for one, which I talked about earlier, which is the vulnerability of it. And the second thing is, it's almost like, I feel like every time I've even took a stab at it, it's like, because I don't know what I'm up against, my thought patterns that produce these negative results, I was using those same thought patterns as my exit strategies, which just put me in a revolving loop.
Yes, right, exactly. So these thought patterns, they're like lenses we see things through. So this awareness helps us to, oh, I got these glasses on again. Let me take them off. Because you cannot change something unless you are aware of it and unless you have a certain degree of understanding about it and facility with addressing it. And that comes with practice.
And with this practice, is there also a almost mindset shift needed that correlates to letting go of the past? Because I've seen a few of these thought patterns are to do with using our past experience to produce certainty over the future. Is there almost a sense that we need to humble ourselves in the sense that, hey, we are not fortune tellers of this world, and our past doesn't tell us everything about our future? Is there a sense of letting go of the past that's needed?
It depends on how we hold it. I think holding it differently is probably more along the lines of where I would go than letting go of it, because not only does it have value if you look at it a particular way, but it's a part of you. It's a part of your history. It's a part of your experience. So I created this 10 episode podcast called From Failure to Fulfillment. And it highlights that failure, which most people hate and avoid, is actually our friend. Friend, analyze, investigate, learn, understand, regroup, and execute. So whether it's something that happened to you or something that you did, it's important to be able to look back at that, analyze, investigate, learn, understand, regroup, and execute, because everyone experiences failure. The most successful people have failed. It is a part of our life, but it doesn't determine our value, doesn't determine our future, unless we entirely, you know, let it go and lock it away, because we tend to repeat these experiences. It's like music. It's a recap or a recapitulation or a modification of a theme, but it's the same thing. So people move from this relationship to this relationship to this relationship, but they're carrying the same patterns based on the same patterns of thought, right? Their emotional reactiveness to something that wasn't addressed, something that wasn't understood, something that we didn't grieve, something that we didn't grow through. So being able to reflect on the past is useful, depending on how you're doing it. I call it constructive reflection. So some of us are naturally reflective, but when we reflect, it is tearing us down and breaking us down, whereas it can build us.
This is so interesting. I did an episode. I'd like to think it's episode 9, and you'll find it amusing that I did an episode on this, especially with something specific to you. I did an episode about moving on, letting go, whether it was relationally with this influencer called Will Keep It Real, amazing guy. And I'd like to think there's just a key lesson that I take from one of my episodes, or I write it down. And the biggest lesson I took from that episode, and I'm bringing it up to you, fascinatingly, is the sense of forgiveness. And you have a brilliant book called The Art of a Genuine Apology. And the reason I brought up this idea of letting go of the past is after I understood Will's idea of forgiveness and apologies, my idea to let go of the, or my idea to use my past for my advantage has gone a lot more sustainable. And his idea of forgiveness was, forgiveness, we typically see it as a social dynamic where it's almost like, hey, I used to think I'm sorry was, hey, we're completely good now, like, da da da. But for me, and what I've realized is forgiveness is almost a self concept. It's, in his mind, forgiveness was just a sense of you've accepted what's going on and you're allowed to move from that situation. It's not a sense that you're okay with everything, but it's almost like there's this acknowledgement of what happened and you're ready to embrace that. I'd love to hear your point, your take on a genuine apology and what that means.
Okay. Ooh. So, I wrote The Art of a Genuine Apology in 2017 after years of witnessing people, whether they're couples or family members, attempt to address significant hurt with an apology, and then they make things worse. So the book was designed to be a pocket's guide. Initially, the initial concept was like, don't do this when you're offering an apology. Things like saying, but, I'm sorry that, I'm sorry if, or people explaining, oh, I did this because those things will ruin an apology. But it grew as I wrote it to acknowledge that a genuine apology not only has certain criteria to make it genuine, like the Mona Lisa, it is, you know, it's a genuine artifact because it features these criteria. So there's that aspect of a genuine apology, but a genuine apology serves as a bridge from forgiveness to reconciliation. All three of these are different. So a lot of people think that forgiveness is the same as reconciliation, or they have to be tied together, which is not true. So I just finished the draft of my next book, which is called...
Let's go!
Yeah. It's called Before the Apology, The Heart Work of Forgiveness. So this really cements the fact that forgiveness is not the same as an apology or reconciliation. So I agree. It is primarily an internal experience that only requires one. But I'm also coming at this from a Christian faith spiritual dynamic about what forgiveness means in relationship to God and the self. So how we relate to God, how we commune to God and with God, and how he helps us in that process. Because, my friend, a lot of people think that forgiveness is just a choice, but it's a choice and a process. And there are, in my estimation, seven phases to forgiveness that most people don't know about, like the patterns. They don't realize, oh, I'm here in this process. So they end up circling and cycling through what I call denial, acceptance, and refusal. And they get stuck there and they cycle through that. They refuse to forgive because of misconceptions, what they think forgiveness means. So they don't move out of that phase and into alignment and then on into awareness. So alignment is where we say, okay, you know what? My body, my soul, my spirit knows the quality of life that I'm experiencing because I'm not forgiving. That's not good for me. But then we bounce back. We're like, but no, I can't. I can't forgive this person. I can't forgive them. Because we think that forgiving means letting it go. Forgiving means saying it's okay. Forgiving it means this didn't really matter. Forgiving it means I have to be in relationship with this person and we have to be all good. If we believe those things, then we get stuck. But forgiveness, where there is significant hurt, there is significant loss. And where there's loss, there is grief. And where there's grief, it's important that there be grieving. People don't realize that. So they don't realize it's loss, but they feel the grief, they feel the hurt, and they don't have a process to acknowledge their loss. Because loss is when you lose somebody, a pet or something. But no, you can lose a sense of trust. You can lose freedom. You can lose hope. You can lose a lot of things in these interactions. But loss is personal. So whether or not this person understands how they've impacted you doesn't mean that they haven't. So if we wait to experience the freedom of forgiveness until this person acknowledges the impact, which they probably have no idea about how deep it is, then we are forever waiting on them to heal.
Yep. Yeah. Bit of a deep question, but how much of this reconciliation can be applied to ourselves? Because I'm drawing a link here, and tell me if the link is real or not. A lot of the time when, I'll just speak on my personal experience, when I have these thought patterns that we talked about earlier, and I derive it from the past, it's almost like, maybe I'm using the wrong word here, but I struggle to, I don't want to say forgive myself in the past, but it's almost like because I have a certain amount of, maybe a grudge, I don't know, towards how I've acted in the past. I'm like, hey, this is how it's going to happen in the future. And is that almost a lack of reconciliation or lack of grieving? Grieving be applied to ourselves?
Yes, certainly. we experience a lot of internal conflict when we don't act in line with who we want to be or who we believe we should be.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Yep.
So that's actually thought pattern number 6. It's the bonus. Oh, that's unbelievable. It's called the shoulds.
I did not know that, by the way. For anyone thinking, I actually did not know that. It's not like he's told me before on call, sling that in. I didn't know that. So.
Right? So I think it highlights how prevalent and pervasive these thought patterns are. We have them, we don't know. So the shoulds. So when we have expectations of ourselves to live a certain way or know certain things, it's really important to assess how healthy those expectations are. So a number of things contribute to healthy expectations versus unhealthy expectations, including unrealistic expectations. If your expectation of yourself or someone else is unrealistic, then it's not going to be healthy. Or, for example, it might be inappropriate or unfair developmentally. So let me give you an example. A lot of people experience this internal conflict around themselves and their self-worth when they have sexual experiences at a very young age. So whether it's exposure or whether it is inappropriate interactions because of a lack of supervision, or this is someone who is older, right? We often internalize those experiences and identify ourselves with them. And one of the beliefs that we hold is, I should have done something. I should have done something differently. I should have known better. But really, there's a difference between I wish I had and I should have. Did you know? Were you in control? Really? You were exposed to this thing at 8. Like, because we look back, whether we're 18 or 28 or 38, and we look back at that 8-year-old and be like, you should have known. Really? No. This child did not have this life experience that you have. You're looking back, and retrospect is 40-40 in this instance. You should have known. No, you shouldn't have known. You shouldn't have known. So the loss there is this whole history now. I've lived the last 10, 20, 30 years impacted by this belief and this experience. That's my loss. I lost time. I lost relationships. I missed out on opportunities because of the way that I internalized that. That's a loss for me. Based on an unhealthy expectation. So when we recognize that loss and we start to reshape our perspective and the way that we think about that, guess what? We are being reconciled to ourselves. We are being good to ourselves. We are able to see, oh, there always has been great value to me despite my decisions, despite the things that have happened to me. I am still here. And I believe God has wonderful plans for us, wonderful futures for us. I still have a wonderful future. The past doesn't dictate or eclipse the beauty that is ahead of me. So I can forgive. I find myself. I can. So forgiveness isn't saying what you did was okay. Forgiveness is saying, you know what? I'm okay. Forgiveness is saying my future is still okay. Like, you know what? You don't even have to acknowledge. I don't have to go back and change it. I'm good. I'm good.
I like that. And I think this idea that you brought up earlier that we can be our own cognitive behavioral therapist. I write blogs myself where I don't post them. So I don't even know if it counts as a blog. I don't know what it counts as. But one of my ideas was we've got at least me personally, I've got to start learning to be my own best friend, in the sense that if I used the critique that I gave myself on any of my mates, I think I'd have no friends left. I genuinely think I'd have no friends left. Like, they would punch me in the face. And if that's how I'm treating myself, that is the unhealthy expectation I feel like I sometimes have on myself. And yes, I'll be honest, I've said this before, and I continue to have these unrealistic expectations. And maybe that's because I'm narcissistic in the way that, hey, it's hard for me to go, I should have the same standard for myself as other people. I always like to have like this different standard for myself. And it's taken me work to not lower the standard, but just tell myself that not reaching that standard all the time is completely okay. And it just takes that internal work, I guess, that practice of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like a clinician of any kind receives education, and then they practice, then they can journey with people. The same happens for us, you know, in our own individual walk. Even if you're learning from a counselor or whatnot, or from a book, you learn, you increase your awareness, and you practice, and you get better at it. So most of us do have this internalized way of speaking to ourselves. And on the one hand, this is part of the shoulds, right? There's two parts to the should. There is the good, and then there's the judgment. So the judgment comes by way of those expectations. But we don't want to overlook the good of the should. Like, I should change the way that I talk to myself. Well, I think what's good with even your unrealistic expectations is part of you has this drive. You have ambition.
Yeah.
You are a thinker. You're a writer. It is part of who you are to give expression and to give reflection. That is what you do. That's good. So we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We want to say, okay, this is good.
Spot on.
But now let's take a look at, you know, what the judgment is about. You know, where's the value and where's the judgment? So what's the judgment? What are the unrealistic expectations? And then when we can break that down and say, okay, you know what? My goal is to do X, Y, Z. And this is what makes this expectation now healthy. I can infuse this expectation with health by doing X, Y, Z and shifting these thoughts. So you don't have to get rid of the ambition or the goal or the drive, but now it's coming from a much healthier place. I'm doing this because of desire, not because of desperation. One is based on inspiration and healthy motivation, and the other is unhealthy motivation.
Oh, you're spot on. I read this somewhere else. Or at least I heard it from my favorite podcaster, Chris Williamson, and these traits that we sometimes deem as negatives are usually double-edged swords. The positive traits that we have usually are the opposites of our negative traits. And he uses brilliant analogy that when you're swinging this double-edged sword, and on the swing back, it may cut yourself. You don't throw the sword out. You just train yourself to be able to maneuver the sword in the right way.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Yeah, I see it as, I tell people they're double-sided coins. And we get to decide which side we're going to look at, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah.
And you don't throw the coin out of the room. Yeah.
No, right? Then you'll be bereft of everything that you've got, because everything has that other side to it.
I love it. Dr. Andrew Blackwood, what a conversation. Time flies when you're having fun. I can't believe it. I actually can't believe it. It's gone already this long. And I ask my guests all the time this, and I'd love your opinion on it. This is the classic Rish Karada hidden mentality ending question, and it's a banger. What is the best advice you've ever received?
Ooh. There's so many categories. Ah. when I got married, I got some good advice for, you know, buying a home. But I'm trying to give good advice.
That's true. I should have narrowed it down. Yeah.
Relative to our conversation today. We've been talking about anxiety and growth and self-awareness, and because most people who struggle with intense anxiety also struggle with esteem and the sense of self and things like imposter syndrome and those kinds of things. So I would say a very important lesson that I learned is quite often when we think about who we want to be in the world, we think about roles and assign purpose and value to those roles. One day I will be a, and it's almost as if until we experience that and achieve that accomplishment, we aren't valuable. But I've learned that the role is about doing, whereas your value and your essence and your esteem is based on being. Mm-hmm. Being who you've been created and called to be. There's only one you. And as you are being that person, you will fill the role in a very unique way. So you are the value, you are your purpose, you bring value to everything that you do and everywhere you go. You are never without value, you are never without purpose, you are never without worth. So when you look out into the world, don't try to see others and say, I want to be like that. In order to be the best version of you, you will not find yourself out there. You are what's missing out there. You get to go out there and be you and contribute to all of the wonder and the good that's out there. So the best expression of yourself, it requires valuing of yourself.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, the way you started off was we wait for these big accolades, and you don't fill internal voids with external accolades. You got to find that internal accolade within ourselves. I love that. That's amazing. Dr. Andrew Blackwood, what an honor it is to have you. Where can we find you and what is next?
Well, coachdrew.ca, the learning center is where you can find me. What's next? I'm excited about releasing this new book.
Let's go!
Yeah, it's coming. So I'm really excited about that.
That's huge, man. It's huge. We will be there. I'll put all the links in the description. You guys can get out to him. What an honor. Thank you so much for coming on today.
I've enjoyed the conversation. You are a great facilitator, a wonderful listener, and a joy to speak with. So anytime.
Stop it. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.